So I could earn like $1,800 in a weekend, which was so exciting. So I think the mixture of learning from my parents, but also finding a job where I could just earn what felt like unlimited money at the time. I always thought I wanted to start a business, but I had no idea what in. Yeah, and I was a lot more naive back then almost. I was like, oh, everyone loves money like me and everyone wants to talk about it like me. So I wasn't expecting some people to get a bit upset by it. But yeah, initially it was very positive. I think it was my parents when I was younger. They both just spoke openly about money. So whenever we were talking about a holiday, we'd budget together. I remember asking for Foxtel one day because all my friends had it. And they were like, well, if you have Foxtel, then we can't have something else. So you've got to pick which one you want. And all those conversations were just very open. But I think now I know when the hate comments are going to come and I can predict them. So it doesn't really get to me as much. The things that do get to me is like the unsolicited advice from so many people. I've definitely made mistakes of being too blunt or missing out a point that I should have made or not considering some people's feelings. Someone messaged me the other day saying they've invested $30,000 since they started following me, which is amazing.
I'm Frances Cook. Welcome to Making Sense, supported by KiwiBank. When you think about starting your own business, the usual advice is to take what you already do for work and turn it into something you can do on your own. So what if an opportunity comes along that's totally different to what you've been doing until now? That's what happened to Tash Invests, otherwise known as Natasha Etchman. One minute she was working as a support worker, finishing her studies to become a full-time occupational therapy worker, and the next, her videos about savings and investments were blowing up online. Making the leap from health to finance and content creation is a fairly big one, but she eventually decided it was time to at least try. Here's how she made it work. I'm joined now by Natasha Etchman from Tash Invests. Now, you made what I look at from the outside and think, God, you're brave. That's quite a scary decision. Made the decision to quit your job. You jumped into the world of self-employment very young, actually. Let's start with, how old are you and how long have you been doing this for?
I am 26. I've been doing this full-time for almost a year, actually. I was 25 when I quit my job.
Far out. That's so amazing. I wish I had that level of confidence in myself at that age. So, okay, let's go back to the beginning. What did you originally train in? And did you ever think of yourself as someone who would start their own business?
I always thought I wanted to start a business, but I had no idea what in. And this kind of stuff all kind of happened a bit accidentally. But my background is in healthcare. So I worked as a support worker for quite a few years and I studied occupational therapy at uni, which I loved. Like, I really did enjoy that job. But then I started posting online like 4 years ago now, just randomly during COVID. I saw a few people in the US who were posting their money diaries and their income, which I thought was really interesting. So I decided to do the same thing. And this kind of took off on the side, which has been really awesome.
It was funny, wasn't it? That especially that first year in COVID and we're all just stuck on our phones. And I think a lot of people sort of were worried about money and talking more about money, which don't love the worrying side of it, but love that we were talking about it. And so when you first started posting, was it literally just your experience and what you were doing? Did you think anything would come from it?
Yeah, no, I didn't think anything would come from it at all. My first post, I think, was like my net worth, maybe. Back then it was like $100,000. I posted my apartment expenses, like how much my strata fees were, how much my mortgage was. I went away on like a little camping trip. I think that was my third post ever. And I posted just how much I spent on the camping trip. And it really blew up very quickly from there, especially on TikTok, thanks to TikTok back then. But I think not enough people were talking about money. So everyone was quite interested and nosy and wanted to hear more. Like, I'm very nosy too. And all that stuff is fun to me as well.
Oh, 100%. I love whenever people will put up their own numbers. Like, what are you doing? What's happening?
Yeah. And I was a lot more naive back then almost. I was like, oh, everyone loves money like me and everyone wants to talk about it like me. So I wasn't expecting some people to get a bit upset by it. But yeah, initially it was very positive.
So you at that point had, did you say net worth $100,000? That's pretty good for someone who was in their early 20s and working as a support worker. What had led you to that? Had you pursued higher paying jobs? Were you someone who saved a lot, invested a lot? What sort of things were you doing in your personal life that had given you this interest and this background with being pretty decent with money?
Thank you. I think it was my parents when I was younger. They both just spoke openly about money. So whenever we were talking about a holiday, we'd budget together. I remember asking for Foxtel one day because all my friends had it. And they were like, well, if you have Foxtel, then we can't have something else. So you've got to pick which one you want. And all those conversations were just very open. And then when I finished high school, I was just 16. So I had a few more years to work until I turned 18. So while all my friends were going out and partying, I was just working quite a bit to save money. And I was really interested in traveling. So I think that really helped me develop the saving mindset. I would save heaps, travel, come back and work a lot to save for the next trip again. And then COVID happened, which was, of course, like terrible, but also really great because I was being a support worker. So all of a sudden there was unlimited shifts. My work didn't get cut. I wasn't doing anything else. So I could just work heaps of overtime. But I think the thing that really benefited me was finding a job where I could kind of almost work unlimited hours. So I was doing sleep shifts in a group home. And you got paid every hour that you worked, but you could do 64-hour shifts in a row, which was amazing. So I could earn like $1,800 in a weekend, which was so exciting. So I think the mixture of learning from my parents, but also finding a job where I could just earn what felt like unlimited money at the time.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? It strikes me of that idea of front-loading your effort, which actually is a lot to do with investing as well, right? But when you are in those stages where you are younger and you hopefully, not everyone, but hopefully have more energy, a bit more time, you don't have dependents on you who need you home, you know, you can just throw yourself into it and say, how much mileage can I make from this right now? And then if you do something smart with that, it can really, really help you in the future. The trick, of course, is to do something smart with it. I know a lot of people who go aim for these high earning jobs while they're younger and then live a real high life. So how did you balance that? Did you know you wanted to build towards that financial security, financial independence at that point?
I didn't really know what it was that I was doing longer term. I just knew that I liked saving and I really enjoyed like almost the buzz I got from saving money. Like it was a big, like, I loved all the milestones. I loved tracking everything. I was really frugal. Like I loved saving every single dollar and tracking every single dollar. But I didn't really know what for initially until I came across the FIRE movement a bit later on. And I was like, wow, this is the best thing ever. But my first investment was when I was 18. My dad was like, this is probably a good ETF you should buy. So I just bought it and kind of learnt from there. But yeah, I didn't really know why. I just liked being obsessed with money.
I love this from your parents. It seems like they were always encouraging these open money conversations and talking to you about it and trying to guide you in a way without, it sounds quite low pressure guidance,
yeah,
from the way you've described it so far. I mean, he brought up an ETF to you, which for anyone who hasn't tried those out yet, that's a share market investment. So had they talked to you about things like the share market and how that works and investing and all that good stuff?
I was very curious about investing, but they are more property investors and my mum is terrified of shares and hates them. And it's always been like a little bit of controversy between my parents. But they were also open to talking about it anyway. And I think it was just modeling the conversations. And like, I was always the kid who was asking questions about like, how much did you earn? Or like, how much was that boat? Or how much was that car? And they just answered those questions for me. I remember when I was like 10 or something, I heard my dad talking about shares with his friends. And then he tried to explain what shares were using a tomato sauce bottle. He was like, you can buy 1/10 of this tomato sauce bottle. And that made no sense to me back then. But I think it was just like they indulged my curiosity without pushing things onto me. And they also admitted when they didn't know stuff. Like my dad was buying single stocks in different businesses and he didn't recommend that for me. But he also openly spoke about that and openly spoke about the money he'd lost as well. So I think, yeah, it was just those really open conversations where it was just a normal part of life rather than you should do this. It's just like, here's what we're doing and why, and you can do with that what you will.
I love that so much, particularly what you say there about being open about mistakes, because I think that's a trap. It's really easy to fall into as a parent. And I still already, my son's only 2.5, and I still catch myself falling into that trap sometimes where you kind of want to act like you haven't made mistakes and you need to listen to me because I'm right. And it's so easy to do that as a parent. And yet, that's something that comes up as well when people send me questions, when they say, you know, I want to make sure that my kids don't make the mistakes I did. I think there's so much power in being open about those mistakes in a low stakes way. Just be like, oh, you know, I messed up. It wasn't the end of the world. Here's how I recovered. because mistakes are going to happen, right? And when you have the confidence to know, okay, mistakes do happen and I can recover, it gives people that confidence to also take risks, which is so important.
Yeah, definitely. And not trying to live up to this high standard that you'll never achieve as well, because your parents will always seem more successful than you. I think one of the really important things that I learned was just watching my parents talk about money, because my dad likes to take risks and my mom is very risk averse. So seeing them navigate those conversations is really interesting as well, because I'm kind of more like my dad and I'd be like, oh, why not just buy those shares? But then I'd hear like mum's fears around those, and just seeing how they kind of met in the middle was really cool as well.
I love that. It's so funny as well. It's so common that you have those two personality types matching up together. Then constantly trying to negotiate that difference through the rest of it. Although probably a good thing. Can you imagine if you had two enthusiastic risk takers together? That would probably burn down pretty quick.
They definitely even each other out for sure.
yeah, exactly. So you started talking about money and your finances online. As you say, TikTok at that point was so powerful. It still can be powerful now, but it's certainly not the heyday that it was. At what point, when you're putting this stuff online, did you start to think, oh, actually, I think this could be something here?
It happened pretty quickly. I think I got my first paid sponsorship like 4 months in, which was amazing. But I was very against the idea of doing social media full time for so long. Like, I kind of denied it for 3 years and I was like, no, this is not what I want to do. I don't want to do this full time, until I was kind of forced to make the choice. Like, things got really busy. I had lots of really cool opportunities. I started my podcast, which is awesome, but it was a lot more work than I thought it was going to be. So for years, I was just like, no, this isn't for me, until it had to happen. But yeah, I think pretty literally like 4 months in, I saw that there was an interest and brands were reaching out as well.
Right. So that is pretty quick, to be honest. And I can understand what you're saying about resisted doing it full time, because it's funny, isn't it? Someone referred to me as an influencer the other day, and I felt myself sort of be like, no, I'm not. You know, I was like, no, I'm a journalist. And it's funny that there's a stigma around it, no matter what type of content you're posting. And I wouldn't have asked you on here if I didn't think you'd do good content. So you're obviously putting good content out there that is really interesting, really useful to people. And yet it can feel funny and quite diminishing to say, I'm a content creator or an influencer or whatever other version that people want to call it. How did you reconcile that? Because obviously you're here now, you've made the leap.
Yes. I think one of the reasons I didn't want to do this full time is because I really enjoyed my job and the work that I did. Like, it wasn't like I hated my job and wanted to quit to start this amazing business. Like, it was a really tough decision to leave. I do struggle with the influencer thing as well. Like, I like to be like, I'm a podcaster and a content creator, but like, I am an influencer. I do influence people to do different things, hopefully positive things. I think it was just like, I was more forced to do it rather than just being like, okay, this is something that I really want. Like, my Instagram was growing, which was amazing, but it was creating issues at my job because I was working in positive behavior support. So I was working with lots of people with very challenging behaviors. And usually you kind of want to be anonymous online to try and keep yourself as private as possible, because people do like to Google you. But having an online profile talking about money definitely was a bit of a conflict in that role. So it was either kind of like, I need to do one or the other for now. And that kind of helped force me to make that decision. But yeah, I think it's just reminding myself that I am doing positive things and people do enjoy the content, and it is benefiting more people than I ever would have been able to benefit one-on-one in my job. But sometimes when you get those comments about, oh, you're just an influencer selling products, like, that can be a bit hard as well.
And it's funny because you, obviously being based in Australia, I would say Australia probably has the strictest rules in terms of the ways you can talk about money online. Every country does have rules. New Zealand, it's you can't be giving advice, which is you cannot be recommending specific products or saying you must do it this way, which, brilliant. I think it's an excellent rule. Australia, to even talk about money online, you have to be registered, don't you? And that's actually a pretty new directive. There was a big boom of the sort of finfluencer movement, some doing great work, some doing not so great. Around that COVID time, the Australian authorities responded, really made it quite strict to be even able to talk about money. What was that change like for you when they announced that?
I think I'd always been waiting for something like that to happen. I'd kind of been researching it beforehand, and because some people, it was kind of like the content creators versus the advisors a little bit almost, where the advisors were saying, you're not allowed to do this, but other people were saying we were allowed to do it. And I tried to get different legal advice, but people were interpreting the laws differently because they were written back in 2001, I think it was, like before social media was a thing. So I was kind of looking into it, and I wasn't surprised when it happened, but there wasn't really much direction. They were like, you need to get licensed, good luck. But there's not that many people who are licensed to give general advice. It's usually just like, you're a financial advisor and you give personal advice. I was really lucky because the company reached out to me to license me and kind of kickstarted that process for me. And from there, I kind of had a framework to go and negotiate with other people. I got some ridiculous quotes though. Like some people wanted to charge me $6,000 a month to be licensed.
A month?
Which is insane. Like that's more than I was making back then, which is crazy. And they also wanted equity in my business too. So it felt like people were trying to really take advantage of that situation.
Yeah, agree.
Luckily, I found someone who would license me for like a reasonable price, and they kind of walked me through the process. But again, like everyone makes up their own like education requirements for what you need to be licensed to give general advice, just depending on what the company wants. But I had to do a few Capline courses. That's like the financial advice kind of space in Australia, the education space. And I had to do a cert for in mortgage broking as well, which was a bit random, but that was fun. And then I had to do all the usual like checks, get references and things like that.
I love how you say getting certified for mortgage broking was fun. You absolute nerd.
So, yeah. It's definitely made for people who've never like studied before, because there was a whole module on how to like use your mouse and set up your keyboard. And I'd never done TAFE before. I'd only gone to uni. So I was like, wow, this is interesting.
Okay, that does sound quite funny. So how long did all of that take you, jumping through those hoops?
I think the ASIC thing came out in like March 2022, and I was licensed by the end of that year. So over 6 months. And most of that was just figuring out what I needed to do, because there's no like guide of this is the steps of getting licensed. It's kind of like you've got to go figure it out yourself. So it was more figuring it out, negotiating it, seeing what I was signing up to, because most people want you to sign like 3-year contracts with them, which is massive as well and a lot to commit to. And then yeah, doing all the courses as well. I think there was like 7 I had to do in the end.
Especially a 3-year commitment when you are just starting out and it's already grown so much in such a short time. A 3-year commitment at that point, when you don't really know what the future holds and it could keep growing at a huge rate of knots, that's a big commitment, isn't it?
Yeah. And especially then I wasn't doing it full time and I didn't think I wanted to either. So I was like, do I just kind of like move on and give up now? Or do I actually keep going with it? Because it's like a lot of stuff to do for a part-time side thing.
So when you started to get to the point where it was taking up a lot more time, you're getting these exciting opportunities, you're enjoying it, but you also, you know, you've gone to university for your other job and you enjoy it and you get something else that's really meaningful from that and you're trying to weigh it up. What was that thought process like? You know, did you literally have to sit down and do a pros, cons list, that sort of thing?
I didn't know. I was thinking about it, but no, it kind of just got to the point where it was too overwhelming to do both. But my thought process was more, I can always go back to being an OT or working in PBS. There's always allied health jobs around. So there's a huge shortage. Like it's something I can always jump back into. But this stuff is very time limited. Like I don't know if TikTok will disappear tomorrow or Instagram will just go down or if my following will just completely die off. Like this is something that's popular right now. So I should take advantage of it. But like you can always go back to your other job. And that's kind of my mindset. Plus I use these skills anyway all the time to communicate with people. I think that's why my content is easy to understand because I have that background as well. I'm doing some money coaching at the moment, one-on-one with people. And a lot of that is more OT rather than actual financial advice because most people just kind of need like the confidence to invest rather than the skills.
I love that. This is something we talk about a lot when we talk about, you know, becoming self-employed or side hustles, things like that. The idea of these transferable skills where you can build on what you've already got in a job that you may or may not like. There's usually some sort of skill set you've built up through that, no matter what. And can you transfer that to something else? The way you've just taken those transferable skills, that's not something I would have seen coming. Did you think that there would be so much that would transfer between the two?
No, not initially, because I was just doing like content and the podcast, but I was really missing working with people. So I was like, well, how can I bring back some of the OT stuff into what I'm doing every day? And money coaching came up. But even since then, I've had like offers to go work for NDIS like companies and actually work and do money coaching with people who are receiving NDIS payments. So that's like Australia's disability support payment system. So yeah, it's like opened up a lot of doors, which has been really awesome.
That's so interesting. And I also like how, as you've been building this, you know, your own business, self-employed, which do you prefer? Do you see it as your own business? Do you see it as self-employed, bit of both?
Yeah, I'm more moving towards business now because I set up a company, which is exciting, but I still kind of think of it as self-employed because I don't have like employees and stuff.
We'll call you a solopreneur for now. That's the new buzzword, isn't it? Yeah. So I like what you're doing there, where you're saying, actually, I feel like I'm missing this aspect from lifestyle, really. If we're going to talk about it, often when we talk about lifestyle, we're talking about our personal lives, but I think lifestyle applies to our working lives just as much, if not more, right? And you're saying, I'm missing seeing people. How can I do that? And you're very much designing your career opportunities, your money-making opportunities around personal needs. I mean, is that something where you sit down and you sort of plot ahead of like, I would like to hit these milestones now, you know, I'm in charge of my own destiny, I'd like to hit these milestones? Or is it just sort of as you go, you think, this feels like it's missing, and how can I fill that gap?
Yeah, definitely the latter. Like, I feel like since the ASIC stuff a few years ago, I like lost my ability to plan too far ahead. Like, I'm like, oh no, this could fall apart so quickly. So I'm definitely more of a short-term planner. But yeah, it's definitely been like I felt really lonely for a little while. Like, all of my friends were working their jobs. Like, people are really busy. Being online can be quite isolating. So I was like, cool, how do I get more people in my life again? And what do I enjoy? Which is how the money coaching came up. And I've been trying to go to cafes in the morning or go to co-working spaces. But it's definitely like, what's missing? What am I upset about now? And how can I fix that? When I have like really bad days, I do scroll on Seek and I'm like, should I just get another job and move on? But like, jobs aren't the answer right now. No. I gave myself like a time frame where I try it for at least a full year before I actually applied for a job again.
How long's it been now?
A year now.
Oh, so how are you feeling?
Yeah, good. With all the book stuff coming out, like, that's really busy. Like, I kind of built up a nice routine with money coaching. I also moved cities, which didn't help as well. So I had to make new friends in a place where I didn't have a job. I was just working for myself, which is quite challenging too. But now I've got friends as well. But no, I think I like know that I can't realistically give any time to a job right now, and also travel around and do all this fun stuff too. So definitely happy just doing my own stuff for now.
And I think that is the big thing as well. When I look at particularly the self-employed world, or when you're in business, but it's just you, it is all on you. Whether it's, you know, in the business or in your personal life, work is how so many of us make friends. But it's also, you know, when you go into the office and if you're struggling with an issue, you can turn to someone at the desk next to you and say, look, this isn't going great. You know, do you know how I fix this?
Yeah, I miss having a manager where you're just like, hey, yeah, this is a problem. Can you like fix this for me?
And now you have to do that.
Yeah, there's no other person. Yeah, especially when I've had like a big day and I'm trying to like decide whether I want to take on like this opportunity or not. Like, yes, I have friends I can talk to. There's no one else who's fully responsible for it. It's just all on me, which can be really hard.
Yeah. And I think this is the thing as well, is this has been both freeing and a little terrifying for me, is to realize that nobody else is operating off a roadmap either. You know, I did political journalism way back, and I remember having the horrifying realization that a lot of the prime ministers, presidents, whatever, are all often operating off gut feel. Quite terrifying, considering the level of decisions that they're making sometimes. But it's also quite freeing in that nobody else has this roadmap in front of them of, oh, this is how you must handle this. It's a range of options. Now what? You know, and you don't know how it's going to go every time. So when you're looking at your options, do you have support that you use to help you, or have you created systems that help you get through this? How do you do this?
No, I definitely don't have enough systems yet. That's something I should have. It's just whenever I get excited about something, like if something lands in my inbox and it gives me a little bit of anxiety, it's probably a no. But if it's like, oh my God, yes, I want to do this. But before this, I was like, I never want to write a book. That sounds like a horrendous idea. I hated uni assignments. I hated doing my honors thesis. Like, I never want to do that ever. And then it landed in my inbox and I was like, oh, well, how can I say no? This is like so exciting. Because they offered me a book tour and I wanted to do the book tour. So it's like, fine, I'll write the book for the book tour. But it's more like that excitement and like whether it aligns with what I'm trying to do. So going back to like what my purpose is on social media, am I deviating too much? Because of course there's like offers that sound really nice, but actually take away from my purpose online. And then I rant to my boyfriend or my friends. I've got a few friends who do similar things online as well and try and get their opinions. But I feel like I usually know. Either it's like a yes, or I try and convince myself it's a yes, but I know deep down it's a no.
What's the old thing? If it's not a hell yes, it's a hell no.
yeah, if I procrastinate replying, it should be a no, because sometimes I just do not want to reply to things.
That's such a good one. Yeah, if you procrastinate replying, I should steal that little tip, actually. That's a good one. What about in terms of the finances of it? Of course, that's what you talk about so much. How do you turn talking about money on TikTok and Instagram? Great, you've got a pretty big audience. How do you actually turn that into a business that supports you?
Yes, good question. Most of my money comes from sponsored content or podcast ads now, which is exciting. But I was very lucky that Perla, who I've been working with for years beforehand, gave me an ongoing contract. So I got paid every month from them, which kind of gave me enough to quit my job and know that I would be able to survive off that income alone. And then anything else is a bonus. So that was really good in giving me the freedom. But because I've been investing and saving for my whole life, pretty much. So I had a really good buffer saved up already. And I also had almost $150,000 in shares back then. My apartment was positively geared. So I was making $100 a week from that. So I kind of had all those things saved up to help me along the way as well. But yeah, I was kind of just having the safety net and then being like, oh, we'll see what happens. If not, I'll go back to work in a year.
I love that. And knowing that you came from an industry where there was huge demand, right? That must have given you the confidence of, look, if I really have to go back to a job, I'm going to get one.
Yeah. Or even like just what I've been doing online now, I get offered jobs all the time. Like I get offered so many marketing jobs or like come work with us in our product management department or something like that. So I also knew that I'd opened enough doors that I'd always be able to get a job if I really needed one.
And in terms of, you know, when you were looking at, okay, what are the ways that you can monetize this, turn this into an actual business? How much research did you have to do on what options were out there and what were the good ones? Because I think every industry struggles with pricing and it's hard to figure out what's the sort of rats and micey stuff versus the big opportunities that can really last. But I think even more so when we're talking the online world, it's not like it's unionized or yes, anything like that. It's hard to figure out, right? So how did you figure out the opportunities and research that?
Yeah, well, I think because I've been doing it for a few years beforehand, I kind of knew the opportunities out there and I knew the ways they would come in. Like, for example, January is really popular for money content. So there's a lot of sponsorship opportunities there, especially in June, July, end of financial year. But in terms of pricing, like I still struggle with that. Like you're really making stuff up just depending on like what you've seen others do. But I think it was just talking to other people, especially trying to not give someone a number first, like trying to get the company to give me their budget first, definitely. Messaging people I know work in influencer marketing, just kind of doing that research by talking to people. And slowly over the years, like it's been almost 4 years now, I've kind of gotten a good idea of what people are doing, but it changes so quickly. Like the rates that I was charging in December, people are saying no to them now because they're like, oh no, we've got less marketing budgets this year, which is quite interesting. So it does change all the time. I've definitely learned how to negotiate. That's been an interesting one because I never used to have to do that at all in my previous life.
I know. I find that whole side of things really tricky. I don't really do much of that with my social media, but I do things like speaking events. And it's a similar thing in terms of there was just so many people wanting speakers last year and they didn't really care when it came to the budget. They just signed off. And then this year, companies are sort of pulling back on the spending and there's a bit more pushback. And so you end up having to do this back and forth over money, which does anyone like it? I hate it.
No, especially when you know they're kind of just like trying to get, like, you know, you have to kind of do the dance almost. It's like, can I not just say this? And you say yes straight away.
Yes.
Like, please.
Please, this is awful for all of us. Make it end.
Yeah. I think it's just so much trial and error. Like if someone says yes to something, then the next time I'll try for slightly more. But if someone's negotiating really hard, then maybe I'll offer slightly less next time. It's just kind of like seeing the reactions. Like if someone says yes straight away, it'll be like, oh, maybe I haven't charged enough because they didn't try and fight it out with me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also feel like, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, both in terms of when you're researching what's out there and when you're negotiating with people, you know, anytime you are looking for this information or then putting it into practice, it sounds really dumb and simple, but there are so many people who seem to take an almost aggressive approach to these things. And I think it really doesn't work out, or at least maybe that's my experience as a woman, that it really doesn't work out for us. People don't like it. But, you know, I think you can get really far by being firm and confident with what you're trying to communicate, but sugarcoating everything, let's be honest. I think people don't necessarily mind a negotiation as long as you're not acting like a dick.
Yeah, definitely as long as I found like having lots of data to back it up, like sending through my average views of my last 10 or 15 videos, like showing them my story views, always having something extra to throw in, like here's an extra story that I didn't offer you before. So it feels like they're getting a really good deal. But yeah, also just being a nice person. Like, how was your weekend? Following up on what they've been doing. I follow lots of like the brand people on social media so I can see what they're doing as well. Just like being a nice person definitely gets you really far.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Yeah, exactly. Oh, that thing you did with the kids looked really fun. Was it good? Should I go? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. How was your cruise? I want to go on one too. Yes.
Exactly. Exactly. You mentioned before about some of the things that can happen, sort of the backlash, the nasty comments that you can get from social media. And I'd love to touch on that a bit more because I think we've seen more people who are in the content creator space talking openly about this and how hard it can be, where so much of the job is about engaging with people and talking to people. And often it's actually a really enjoyable part of the job when it's going well. I loved online about the different things they've done that have worked for them, that haven't worked for them. I feel like it keeps me across different people's experiences. And I think that's important when we're talking money, remembering the different lives people have. And yet some people are awful. Some people are just so, so nasty. And you just think, wow, are you having the worst day? Because I have no idea what sparked that. That's nothing to do with what we're talking about here. And you're in. Wow.
Yeah.
So when you get things like that, does it affect you?
It used to early on, so I was a bit shocked by it. Like, I'd always grown up in a family that was open about money and supported me in doing whatever I wanted. I worked in a very female-dominated industry where you could kind of do whatever you wanted and you were empowered. And then I started talking about money online and I realized how sexist a lot of people still could be. And that shocked me initially. But I think now I know when the hate comments are going to come and I can predict them, so it doesn't really get to me as much. The things that do get to me is like the unsolicited advice from so many people. Like, no matter what I say, someone will have an opinion on it. Like, even if it's not negative, it's just like the hundreds of messages about how I've cooked my rice wrong, or like I shouldn't have used those brands of dumplings, just like that kind of stuff. Because like, your brain isn't meant to have all of those opinions all of the time. So sometimes I find that a little bit exhausting. So things I don't expect, where I'm like, oh God, I wasn't ready for that.
Yeah. Like, I am always too highly caffeinated and I often make little videos where I'm making a coffee and people will be in the comments be like, no, you're making it wrong.
Oh, not the coffee. Like,
it's instant. There's no way you can make it right. This is just for warmth and caffeine. And there's no perfect coffee coming out of there, guys.
Well, I had someone tell me that using microwave rice was really off-brand and irresponsible because it was cheaper to make rice in your rice cooker. I was like, oh my gosh, like I can't believe rice is throwing like off my brand completely.
Off-brand and irresponsible for the rice you ate. How dare you?
Yeah, because I spent $1.50 on rice. I find that stuff challenging because I've not got like my armor on for it. The rest of the stuff, like it's daddy's money or you've worked really hard or you're lying or like go back to the kitchen, I expect all of those and I can make them into really good content. But the other stuff where it's like, oh my God, did I offend someone with my rice? Like, I didn't mean to do that.
Yeah. And I think as well, sometimes when people message something, because when you're talking online a lot, every now and then you are going to get it wrong. There's going to be times where actually sometimes the criticism is valid. And I think I get a similar vibe from you. I mean, the reason I talk about money online is because I genuinely care about trying to put out information that can help people, right? I get a very similar vibe from you. And so when someone will be like, actually, you haven't thought about this and what you've said is really hurtful and offensive, sometimes they're right, sometimes they're not. But and the times when you think, you know what, even if I don't agree with your entire point, I think there's a kernel in there. That can be hard, right? Do you find that hard?
Yeah, well, I love people's feedback sometimes. Like, it is really valid. And social media is quite a challenge in terms of balancing being responsible and giving all the information, but also making a video that will do well and get seen by more people. So a lot of the time the nuance is missed, which can offend people. I've definitely made mistakes of being too blunt or missing out a point that I should have made or not considering some people's feelings. But it's hard to be like, you can't make content for everyone. Things will be missed. But also I don't want to make people feel bad as well. So it is hard to juggle that. And I do take on feedback like that as well. And I don't want to make people feel bad. Or if I make something like, if you invest now, you'll have this much. But if you start 10 years later, this is how much you'll lose. Like, that really gets to people. And on one hand, it motivates people to start now, but it also upsets other people as well. So trying to balance that and being like, okay, my next bit of content can be like, here's how much you'll make from $5 a day or something smaller and more achievable and trying to balance that out. But it is hard when like you get so many messages. And I think we read things how we want to read them. So when I'm in a bad mood, I'll read someone's message as being really aggressive when it's not, like they could have meant it in a nice way. So just stepping back and reminding myself that people mean well, and it's probably just me who's overreacting and it doesn't actually matter.
100%. I have now learned that if I am having a bad time, I should just take a break. I should not try to power through it because I will take everything the wrong way. Sometimes people will leave a comment and they actually didn't mean anything by it, or it was totally neutral to them, and I'll take it offensively. I'm the one starting a fight, which is not great.
I always read them out to my boyfriend if I think someone's being mean, and he'll be like, oh, that's nice. I'll be like, oh, okay, that's my fault then.
Yes, extra pair of eyes, very helpful. You mentioned before about the nuance, and I think that's the wonderful thing about when you're doing all of this content creation on social media, and then you get opportunities for things like, you know, you mentioned you have a podcast, written a book, amazing. You get these longer form opportunities where you can actually expand on what you've been talking about, get into the weeds a bit more and say, okay, here are all the different things to consider. So talk to me about those. You know, what are these other projects you've been working on?
Yeah, the book I'm actually really excited about now, it's called How to Not Work Forever. And it's a beginner investing guide for Australians. But I wanted it to be really specific because when I started investing, no one was telling me what to buy. Everyone was like, investing is good. You should invest in an ETF. But no one would actually like tell me which ones. So we've got advisors who've given us example portfolios, which is awesome. They've ranked super funds based on performance as well. So it's very like all the information you need, but you can actually see the products and go and buy them if you want. We've mentioned specific brokers as well. It's not like the Barefoot Investor where there's only one or two options. Like, you've gone through multiple options too. And then the podcast is kind of a similar thing as well. Like, I wanted it to get straight to the point, but be able to teach you how to invest in the right order. Something I also struggled with was hearing bits and pieces from lots of different people and not knowing like what the starting point was. So with our podcast, we did the first 10 episodes. It's How to Invest in the Right Order.
And name of your podcast, please?
The Get Rich Slow Club.
Love it, which of course you co-host with Anna, who is also going to be coming on my podcast very soon, because I love both of you do. I just think it's brilliant to have women putting out this really smart, sensible, well-vetted information. I love seeing it. And I think social media can be so powerful in terms of you reach people who are feeling a bit funny about money, but they don't know where to start. And you end up just sort of landing in front of them and saying, oh, here's, you know, one or two tips or tricks. But most videos, you know, they're a minute or they're 2 minutes. And you might, you know, if you put out a little infographic, it might be a couple of slides. But when you then can take it further and you do a book or you do a podcast and you get to dive into the weeds, it can be really rewarding, right? Because you're in these areas where you wouldn't be here if you didn't think it made a difference. You're in these areas where you're trying to help people out and you're getting the chance to jump into it. So how does it compare in terms of obviously your previous work in the health space was very obviously helping people out. This is quite different, but a similar sort of bent, I feel.
Yeah, definitely. I think I definitely lose sight of how many people actually find my content helpful, because a lot of people will not really message if it's helpful. They'll just message if they're really angry at you.
Yeah.
So I do miss that sometimes. unlike in person when I was like talking to people's mums or their other support workers or their other therapists, and you could really see the tangible difference. But I do still get so many lovely messages about people who, like someone messaged me the other day saying they've invested $30,000 since they started following me, which is amazing. Or someone else said they bought a house. They wouldn't have been able to do that without our podcast, which is amazing as well. So I've got like I did prac at this school a few years ago for OT, and they did this thing called Warm Fuzzies, where every Friday morning they give each other a note of something nice they did that week, and they'd all like collect them in their warm fuzzy jars. So I started doing that on my phone. I've got a notes app called like Warm Fuzzies, and I'll put all the nice messages from people just to try and remind myself that like, yes, it is helping people, definitely.
Oh my God, that's such a good idea. I love that so much. Yeah, I've got to say, some of those messages are my fave. When I get people saying, I've bought a house and that, you know, wouldn't have happened. Just think that's really real. That's people's lives, right? Like, that's so cool. I'm going to have to start saving those messages like you do. If someone else is thinking they would like to make a big career change, because we've talked a bit about the transferable skills. It's still a huge career change going from one very specific field to an entirely different one. Making a big leap and doing it on your own, what would be the tips you'd have for people if they're wanting to make a big change?
I think start slowly, like trial your idea before you go and quit your job. I was doing this for almost 3 years before I went full time. And I even had like a 6 month period where I worked part time and did this part time as well. So I think start your idea, see if people are interested, test monetizing it, see if it's got legs, and then you can slowly transition if possible. Your job or like your career might not let you go part time, but at least kind of be making money already. Like I think I had a really solid business model set up by the time I did quit my job. I knew where the money was coming from. I knew what worked. I knew what didn't work. I kind of had a direction in terms of the podcast, and then the book came soon after as well. But definitely don't just quit your job and be like, okay, cool, what am I doing tomorrow? Like start the business first if you can.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's really smart. I've had a few people come on who've started their own businesses and they've said something very similar, where if you test it on the side first, and then even sometimes by the time that people have come to jump into it full time, it might be slightly different, right, than how you'd originally thought. Was there anything that was different with yours by the time you did quit your job? Was there anything different in how it looked versus how you'd imagined?
I never really imagined what it would be like. I guess the podcast was new. That was like the big thing that finally tipped me over with having too much work to do. I never imagined I'd write a book. But something that really stuck in my mind was I read a Princeton study that said that if you were experiencing financial distress, it's equal to either losing a full night of sleep or a decrease in your IQ by 13 points. So you don't want to like be in a position where you are struggling with money, you're making less good decisions. So it's really good to kind of have a good buffer fund set up first before you put yourself in that situation.
Yeah, I was just going to say, did you have a certain amount of savings to back you? You know, some people talk about the 3 month emergency fund, sometimes people say 6 months. What were you working on to make yourself feel financially comfortable in making that leap?
I think I had $30,000 in savings, but I wasn't really working on like 3 or 6 months. I was also in a good position where like I can always go back to my parents' house if I really need to as well. So it wasn't really like I need X amount of savings. It was like, here's my buffer. I know I've got income in the form of dividends. I know I've got income in the form of my positively geared property as well. And I have that contract with Perla too. So it was more like things are looking up. I can always go back to my parents if I need as well. And I've got like $30,000 can get me quite far.
I love that. And I also love this is something I've been thinking about a lot recently, is the community side of success in life, right? Because I've always believed that nobody truly gets anywhere alone, but you can sometimes really see in terms of, you know, your parents talking to you openly about it and having that option to go back to your parents if you needed it. Having that social safety net can be so important to give you the courage to make a leap. And I think not everyone has super supportive parents, but even if you can build that through friends, other community sort of building, I think that can also be, there's the financial aspect of having a safety net. There's also the community aspect of having a safety net, right?
Yeah. I don't think I give my boyfriend enough credit either, because he works for himself full time as well. And that was a big kind of factor where I saw him doing it. One of my closest friends does it as well. A few other of my friends were starting to do it too. So it was like all of a sudden everyone around me was doing it as well. So it was like, okay, well, I might as well do it too because it's possible. And I'd seen their struggles, but also like the positives as well, and that they were working through them. And also like even with writing a book now, like all of a sudden everyone around me started writing a book, like Emma from The Broke Generation, Kate from Rask, Anna wrote a book as well. Like I go into the finance book section and I know like half the authors, which is amazing. It's definitely like the people in your circle definitely influence your decisions.
What is that old saying that you're the sum of the five closest people to you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so true. It's so true. Isn't it? Like you don't want to be like a social climber or anything, but I do think that surrounding yourself with people who have similar goals, who are also really motivated, who are also pushing themselves towards things and achieving them, even if you're not explicitly talking about things, you often do end up talking about it, but even if you're not explicitly talking about it, it rubs off, right? Just the idea of what's possible.
Yeah, it just normalizes it completely. Like, oh, writing a book is just what people do, and quitting your job to your business is just what people do. Like it's not this massive leap that takes so much energy. It's just like, oh, that's the next step.
Yeah, 100%. All right. Well, if people want to make you one of the five people that they hang out with, even if it's just online, where can people find you and keep following along with your journey?
Yeah, you can come find me on Instagram and TikTok. It's Tash and Bess. And you can come follow the podcast as well, the Get Rich Slow Club.
And of course, your book, How Not to Work Forever, is out now in all good bookstores. Super great book. Do check it out. Thanks so much for coming on. That's Tash and Vests. Now, if you have questions for anything to do with money or something you'd like covered on the podcast in future, do get in touch. I'm on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok as Frances Cook NZ. Don't forget to subscribe to Making Sense and tell your friends about this awesome money podcast you've been listening to. Until next time, have a great day. Just a note before you go. This podcast can only give you general information about how things work in most cases. It's not individual financial advice. We're all different, so some of this might not apply to your specific situation. Take what works for you, ignore the rest. If you're after individual financial advice, a financial advisor is always the best bet.